baby. Won't you please come on home?
Yeah.
That was not my first.
Got you singing today.
That was not my first recording. I thought that made those two tunes kind of went together.
When did you start singing?
When Benny died. Because Benny always sang, but just like one third of the time. And okay. I thought that was perfect. I've always hated going to hear bands that the singer sings every song. I just don't get that. I mean, I don't like it. I don't hate it, but I don't like it. So I thought that was perfect. So Benny sang one third of the time. So even though I know I'm not a singer, I started singing because it breaks it up. And people like to sing along in their head.
Yeah.
So it makes it interesting for the audience instead of everything being instrumental.
Absolutely.
And so at first it was real hard, but I'd change it. I'd move something up a half step one week, and the next week I'd move it back down, and then I'd move it up another half. And it's like, it was all because I couldn't really sing, and so my voice had a range that was like two notes, you know, whatever. But now I don't care. I don't care.
Yeah, you know. It's part of your thing.
It's part of my thing.
You know, I didn't
know. I sing better than I used to.
Yeah, I didn't know you sang. Hmm. Really, until we did a gig, whenever it was, at the Monday night at...
Oh, really?
Where is that?
Oh, the Republic.
The Republic in Grand Rapids.
Yeah.
And you started singing, and I thought, I didn't know he sang.
Yeah.
And but you have your own thing, you know, and it's cool.
I just try to sing with good phrasing and try to sing it too 90% of the time, you know?
Yeah.
And I like singing verses. We knew this guy that we were just talking about him last night, Dave Powers. He was like 6'5", and he'd make me do all these verses because by then I was playing. For a while, after Pete and Paul left, I played five nights a week solo at the Harley Hotel. And so anyway, Dave would come in, and he'd make me play all these verses, and he wouldn't know what the chorus was. He wouldn't know what the song was till he heard the chorus. But after the verse, when I sang it and I sang the chorus, he'd shout out, "Oh, yeah!" every time. So he was fun to play for. But that tune I just played, of course, Baby, Won't You Please Come Home, is a Dixieland tune. And I learned all those tunes from those guys. You know, they were all 40-something, and I was 18, and they'd say, "God, you sounded good tonight, John." I was like, "Wow, why did I write that out? You've already memorized it. I wasted all my time. That whole book, you don't even read it anymore," that kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
They put their arm around me, and they made me feel 10 feet tall. And where would we be without guys like that? You know, when you're young, of course you don't have any confidence. You don't think you're any good. But if they tell you you are and you trust them, maybe you are. You must be. They said you are. And they're really good.
It really means something, doesn't it?
Oh, my God. It changes your life, you know, when you look back on it. Like you and Roy and Swaffield, maybe. Or I'm sure you have a list of 25 guys. You know, we all have our list of guys. When I was in... graduating from high school at Battle Creek Central, Charlie Kirsch, the band director, pulled me outside on the loading dock there to the auditorium, W.K. Kellogg. He said, "John, where are you going to college?" I said, "Olivet." My choir director's got an in there, Pops Richards. He says, "Nope, you got to go to a jazz school." I said, "Why?" He says, "John, you got talent." So I ended up going to Berkeley for a while in Boston. And so I wouldn't have done that if he hadn't pulled me aside. Right?
Yeah.
But he did. But the first jazz I ever heard was Terry Lauer.
What?
See, Terry was more of a role model to me.
Yeah.
He was 3 years older than me. He was
okay.
My brother Jimmy's age.
Oh.
And he played in a bar downtown Battle Creek called Bobby's.
Okay. There's a lot of history here, a lot of Battle Creek history happening. And because I'm from Battle Creek too, all these things are kind of lining up now. You're filling in a lot of blanks for me.
Okay.
So Terry... I get to play with Terry from time to time now,
yep.
And Terry plays all over the place. So you guys grew up together.
We did. He was good friends with Jimmy, and he was the star of the Follies and the band.
Okay.
And at Battle Creek Central. And so he was kind of a role model. So I got to hear my first jazz, and it was Oscar Peterson's On a Clear Day with Terry Lauer, and Bobby Parker was a bass player who owned a bar.
Yes.
So I went in there with my brother Jimmy probably, and I sat there and I heard Terry played it, and I closed my eyes, and I swear I could see Oscar Peterson. And I knew that's what I wanted to do with my life. You know, that was one of those songs that clicks in your head and a light bulb goes on. And that's it. Actually, that wasn't really it. Before then, in 10th grade, I was in Romania when I heard my very first jazz. We were staying in this hotel, and I was looking for a piano to practice in. And in the dining room, they had an upright. I tried to play it, but it was locked, closed. Then I thought the maitre d' was, this big guy, I said, "Can you open it?" He goes, no. 5 minutes later, two more guys shows up. He unlocks it and sits down at the piano. And it's a jazz trio with a bass player and a fiddle player with a fez and a tassel and dark glasses. And they played Hello, Dolly.
In Romania.
And I'm in 9th grade. I'm on a 3-week tour with my 100-voice choir. And I didn't know what it was, and I didn't know how to do it, but I knew that's what I was going to do with the rest of my life.
What was it about the music that grabbed you?
Magic. The absolute magic of it. The mystery of it. The excitement of it.
Wow. And then when you heard Terry, what was it about on a clear day that really spoke to you?
It just reminded me of the record I'd heard of Peterson.
Okay.
And when I heard that, I heard, that's it. So then I became a devotee. I got every Peterson record he ever made, you know, after that.
We're talking about some of these important night spots in
right.
the area, right? So you said the Whistle Stop.
Right.
You said
Sly Fox.
And then you mentioned Bobby's in Battle Creek, which I think I went to once. I think I stepped in there one time during the day to meet somebody. But Bill Dowdy, another great drummer who I'm sure you played with a lot, who was a mentor to me, he would always talk about Bobby's.
Bill Dowdy, the drummer with the three sounds.
That's right.
Andy Simpkins, Bill Dowdy, and Gene Harris.
That's right.
They were just as popular as Shearing or Brubeck, and they played the whole college circuit. And Bill Dowdy had a downtown Battle Creek music store afterward. Dowdy's Music.
That's right.
You're not going to believe this, Keith, what happened to me in there. I walked in and talked to Bill, and he tried to sell me a drum machine. His knees were shot. He wasn't playing anymore. He just wanted to sell something.
Yeah.
So years later, I played Bobby's. Oh, my God, you know, 30 years later, with Max Holly III, Bobby was still alive, and we played at Bobby's again. And then I didn't even realize it's just a converted gas station.
It's really tiny.
It's just tiny.
Yeah.
It's a converted gas station. But it was fun going back and playing there because of what had happened there.
So you mentioned a lot of drummers here that you've played with that you really... learned a lot from. So you mentioned Bill Dowdy, Jim Hampton, Benny Carew, of course.
Jeff Wagnuts,
okay.
W-A-G-N-U-T-S.
Okay.
He was a super interesting guy, very intelligent. And he had a house that he built himself in Dowling. You know that little cow town?
Yeah.
In the woods there, he built a 5-sided house. And he had like a Swedish toilet, like a dry toilet. And he drove a mail van. He collected like mail vans, and he drove those. And Volvos, too. He had like three Volvos in his front yard just that he kept for parts to keep his fourth Volvo going. But he was like I say, he was a real artist and a real gentle, gentle guy. Oh, here's the thing. He taught me... memorize the big band book. He said, "John, I don't read it. You see me reading that big band book?" He said, "You're going to be so happy once you do that." And I was. I was so happy. Because then you're free. Your head's not in the chart and you're in the music.
Yeah, you can listen, right?
And yeah, you're just in it. You're just together with the sound, you know, and you're a rhythm section.
Yeah, it makes such a difference.
Yeah, he was literally something. I got to play the last piano Duke Ellington ever played. He did a concert in Kalamazoo, and then he got sick, and they flew him to New York. He was supposed to be in the town near Battle Creek the next night, and he couldn't play. No, I know what it was. He played in that little town south of Battle Creek. He played there, and I played it with the Battle Creek Jazz Ensemble. He had a piano with lion legs. Lion feet,
oh,
lion
wow.
claws.
Yeah.
And Duke had just played it. and he was supposed to play Downtown Kalamazoo the next night, and he didn't play it, and Harley Paquin played it instead. Huh. Do you remember that? Harley Paquin and Jerry Paquin had a combo, and Harley was such a good piano player that he played in Duke's Place that night, and everybody loved it.
Wow. Yeah, I just know the names.
Yeah.
So you're saying that Duke Ellington's last performance was south of Battle Creek? Was it Coldwater or something?
Yes, Coldwater. Yeah. Thank you.
So that was his last performance?
Yeah, because then he got ill and couldn't play in Kalamazoo the next night.
Wow.
And Paul Gonzalez was drinking a straight big 16-ounce glasses of whiskey at the bar, and he died right after Duke.
Wow.
Yeah. I didn't get to see Duke. I got to see Mercer played on the Battle Creek Mall.
Oh.
Cootie Williams was still alive, and so was Harry Carney and Mercer. For free on the Battle Creek Mall.
Jeez. Don't get to hear that live anymore, do you? I mean, you got to hear some of those guys live, but then you also got to play with a lot of people that played with those types of folks.
Exactly.
Right? So you were just kind of
exactly
one degree away from all those, you know, somebody like me, I'm at least 2 degrees away, you know, usually.
Mm.
So I get to play with you.
No,
and you
no,
played
no, no.
with the guy who played with them. And, no, and that's not too bad, but
no, you're not 1 degree away. You're there.
Well,
you're not even away from it. But I like what you said about me. That's a good way to put me.
Yeah,
I'm 1 degree away. For instance, my my next drummer is Greg Sergo.
Okay,
S-E-R-G-O, and he was my Chicago drummer, and he played with Judy Roberts, Danny Long, all these great everybody in Chicago. He played with Paul Keller. Put us together at Billy's Boathouse. And Frank Derone, that's the other name I was trying to think of, that he played with. Anyway, great swinging drummer. Everything you do, he's going to not interfere with it. He's going to enhance it and bring it to the next line, you know. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, so Paul said, you're going to love John. And he told Greg, you're going to love John. And he told me, you're going to love Greg. And so Greg introduced himself at Billy's Boathouse and hired him to play a party at Spring Lake Country Club. And I started A-Train, and he started playing the ride cymbal, and that was it. The drummer I've waited for my whole life. We got to play together every night for 10 years before he died of lung cancer.
Wow. What was it about his playing, though? He said he played the ride cymbal. What was
he? He had played with Ellington's guys. He had that sound. He was that sound. It's what you just said.
Wow.
He was part of that. And so he had the perfect sound for the perfect song, you know, always. And also, he also was a real interesting Latin drummer. It was like having a Latin rhythm section also, but it was just one guy.
Wow.
He had knitting needles and cowbell on his tom-tom, and I don't know how he did what he did, but he did it, and it sounded like he had a Latin rhythm section too. So he had that too.
Huh.
But he was a swing monster. Wow. See, the other swing monster I played with was Rupert Kettle.
Oh, right. Okay.
He was a Grand Rapids legend. And
yeah.
A legend. Benny Crew would send anybody who wanted to take drum lessons, go to Rupert Kettle. Pete Sears studied with Rupert Kettle. Everybody did. Because fundamentals, paradiddles, that's where you learn it. You go to Rupert's house, he's a New Yorker, he doesn't even drive a car. You go to him. You see in his manuscript paper?
Yeah.
It's like a work of art. They frame it and put it on walls. It's
yeah,
so
it's
pretty.
Beautiful. It is
but
beautiful.
Anyway, played with Rupert and Kurt Purnell, and when Rupert would lay into this huge ride cymbal he had, you got the sensation of water skiing behind a ski boat and just riding this wave. It was just ride the wave, right?
Wow.
But all these guys had sayings, you know? Like, and Benny knew that Carter thought that he was square because he was older. And so in front of Carter, Benny said, you know, nothing is hip or square lest the thinking makes it so.
Whoa.
In other words, I know you think I'm a square, but yeah. You're really the square because your brain is square.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, it probably took him a while to figure that one out, too.
I'm sure he didn't get it.
Really. Man. Well, let's hear some more music.
Oh,
okay. You played something from your first album first. What's the album called?
Works of Art.
Okay.
Yeah.
And who was on that one?
Rob and Greg. Rob Hartman and Greg Sergo, the guy I just mentioned.
Okay.
They're on both my first CDs, 2 CDs.
What would you like to play next?
Oh, I don't know. Something I know. Oh, one of my favorite ballads is on that first record, and I play it alone. I Should Care.